And this is the Feminist Radio Show, and I'm going to be your host today. My name is Anne, and we're going to be listening to a program that I taped on April 13th with author Ariel Levy. So stay tuned for that. She is the author of Female Chauvinist Pig, Women and the Rise of Raunch Culture. So stay tuned. Ariel Levy, who's a contributing editor of New York Magazine. She's the author of Female Chauvinist Pigs and the Rise of Raunch Culture, published 2005 by Free Press. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I wanted to know if you could begin by just defining for our listeners, what is a female chauvinist pig?
Well, the idea behind the title is that if male chauvinist pigs of years past were guys who treated women like pieces of meat, then female chauvinist pigs of today are women who are sort of doing that all on their own and making sex objects of other women and of themselves.
And so then, you know, it seems like this is something that's somewhat new, though. Could you speak about how, even though women have internalized sexism for many years, how's this new in your mind?
Well, I mean, I think just a few years ago, you know, the impetus for me writing this book was that a few years ago, I sort of noticed that everywhere I looked, there were sort of depictions of women that at one point would have been considered degrading or, you know, examples of objectification, like reality television shows about strippers or, you know, there was a memoir of a porn star at the top of the bestseller list, of, you know, at the time and things like that. And at some point along the way, those things got refigured as supposed symbols of empowerment. And so I started, you know, reporting. I went on spring break with a group called Girls Gone Wild. And what they do is they make videos of young women exposing themselves or making out. And the women who were doing it when I went to interview them on spring break in Miami, you know, would say that it was, they had adopted the lexicon of the women's movement, and they would use words like, you know, liberated and empowered, described what they were doing, when to me it sort of looked like just the opposite. It looked like the enactment of everything that feminism had stood against.
Yeah, I mean, your book is full of really frightening anecdotes that are culled from your vast interviews, and I mean, it makes it a wonderful read, and
I
applaud you for this book. It's a daring effort in a climate that is very reticent to try to accept some of these ideas. Some of the things that you mentioned, like the warning of your, you know, your vaginal lips may be ragged and to encourage vaginoplasty, and really stuck with me, as well as the raised bed in the Maxim hot party where the two women in pigtails and lingerie were fighting all night.
Yeah, right, pillow fighting. I think plastic surgery is really an interesting example. I mean, one of the best letters I've gotten was this young woman emailed me just a few days ago, and she said, you know, because I read your book, she was 21, and she said, I'm not going to get the breast implants I was planning on getting, you know, that I've been saving up for since I was 17. And that made me really happy because, I mean, I think that plastic surgery, it's such an interesting thing that breast implants, you know, the number of breast augmentation procedures has gone up over 800% in the last 10 years. And I just think that, you know, it's like the aesthetic of pornography, essentially, the idea that you're going to have your genitals and your breasts either trimmed or enlarged to more closely resemble, you know, the way women look in porn. I mean, and with breasts, you could argue that there's like different styles of breasts come in and out of vogue. I mean, you know, there's lots of people have written interesting stuff about this. But with genitals, I mean, the only place women are really, heterosexual women are really looking at other women's genitals are in pornography. So the idea that there could be, you know, a vaginal style, I mean, I think that says a lot.
And you were also just recently on Oprah Winfrey's show. Could you just, how was it being on Oprah?
Well, it was great for sales, I'll tell you that. She's got a lot of power. No, it was interesting. I mean, you know, I think the reason I wrote this book was sort of in the hopes of starting some kind of dialogue about these issues. And you know, so I was very happy to talk about them in such a prominent forum. And the pop star Pink was there, who was this new video out called Stupid Girls, and it's sort of, you know, satirizing the trend that sort of obligates female stars to dumb themselves down and tart themselves up.
I was sorry you didn't have more time and you were in the audience rather than on the stage, though. How did you feel about that?
Oh, well, you know, I just thought I was lucky to be there.
That's true. I think when Pink was pondering over why she couldn't come up with five young, smart women, and that Angelina Jolie and Natalie Portman came to mind, I thought, wow, we really are in trouble. If those two women who, you know, while, you know, I don't know.
I don't know anything about Angelina Jolie, but Natalie Portman I actually have interviewed for a magazine article, and she is quite intelligent, quite, you know, this is a Harvard-educated young woman who cares a great deal about social justice and puts a lot of time into, you know, not just charities, but political work that's beneficial to women. So, I mean, I do think she's really smart and quite an impressive person. But, I mean, I think the larger point that, you know, that Pink was trying to make was that there are very few young, prominent women whose claim to fame is their intellect as opposed to their hotness. And I think that's certainly, you know, accurate.
I know. I was struck in your book. You mentioned how Oprah on her show was learning the stripper walk.
Yeah. Well, I think it's like, you know, the idea that stripping is a path to, you know, erotic empowerment. I mean, it's so widespread. They have cardio striptease classes at Crunch Gyms, and, you know, Oprah had this stripper on her show. I mean, and also, I mean, I just, forever, you can, there's endless stream of articles in magazines and newspapers about either stripper workouts or sort of strippers themselves, and a spate of television shows, of reality shows about the lives of strippers and the lives of hookers. I'm thinking of Cat House on HBO, which is a brothel show. I mean, I think people are really fascinated by sex work right now and have sort of come to think of sex workers as the people who can teach them about sexual self-actualization, which is, of course, ironic because sex workers are paid to have sex. And, you know, ideally you'd want your sexual role models to be people who are having sex because they want to, I would think.
Exactly. I was struck by the clothing that Pink wore, and Oprah also, you know, they both were wearing what looked like stilettos. And it just, I find that, you know, her outfit looks kind of like a cross between Anna Nicole Smith and Marilyn Monroe. Did you find that troubling, or did you notice a soft focus filter when they go to Oprah?
Well, I mean, you know, I did not know about soft focus filter. But I mean, I think in general, I think it's a real hard puzzle. I mean, what are women supposed to wear? What is a smart woman who wants to project, you know, intelligence and empowerment? What's the appropriate uniform? I mean, I just don't know the answer, you know.
Are you familiar with Sheila Jeffries' book, Beauty and Misogyny?
No, I'm not.
She's an Australian feminist, and she's condemning beauty practices, saying that they're politically limiting, and it's not just a waste of time, but it's expensive, painful, and unhealthy. Anyway, she goes into ways in which the beauty standards are essentially determining women's mobility, spontaneity, posture, gait, and defining her physical freedom. I just wondered.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, I think anybody who's walked around a pair of high heels, you know, can tell you that it hurts. And I mean, anybody who's sort of tried to look attractive by conventional standards can tell you it's time consuming and expensive. I just think, though, that it's so deeply ingrained at this point that it's like, to me, it's like we have so many bigger problems than the time and money women, you know, put into their appearance. I mean, I think that it sort of depends on the example. Like, to me, having surgery that's dangerous. I mean, you know, I've written articles for Vogue magazine about how women die during routine plastic, you know, voluntary cosmetic plastic surgery. You know, so to me, something like that where you're actually risking your life, it's like that's what sort of I would want to start with saying, okay, let's question this. I mean, I think we're a long way from a place where we can sort of really be thinking about whether or not it's important for women, you know, to give up makeup or something like that. I mean, we have so many bigger hurdles before we get to those questions, in my opinion.
That's true. And yet, in your book, you kind of dance around the periphery of questioning gender. And what Sheila Jeffries discusses in this book is to question how these identifiers, these gender identifiers, like the clothing and so forth, you know, are there to make certain that the sexes can be told apart and that it enforces the binary system and so forth. I just wondered if you could comment on that.
Well, I mean, in the book, you know, I talk, there's a chapter about lesbian culture, and I mean, I think that, you know, I can't sort of give a general comment on the book you're talking about because I haven't read it, but I mean, I think that, you know, of course, there are sort of an infinite number of ways to be female or male, and that, you know, none of those come from what you wear or who you sleep with, actually. So I think there's plenty of room for each individual to sort of interpret gender the way he or she sees fit.
That does bring me to a question about that chapter that you wrote on women to boys, W-O-M-Y-N to B-O-I-S.
Mm-hmm.
That lesbianism at one point in feminist history challenged dominant paradigm resisting heteropatriarchy and was very political, and that now it's kind of an empty term, and that you're either a, you know, femme butch top or a boy B-O-I. And I just, you know, it was interesting because you were questioning, I think it was Julian Roskam from Dyke TV, who's getting a mastectomy. Is that kind of where, you, again, with the cosmetic surgery, you draw the line or try to...
Well, I don't think it's up to me to draw the line. I mean, I think that, you know, each person has to decide what he or she feels is going to make them comfortable living on planet Earth. My point in that chapter was just that, you know, I heard over and over again from people that, you know, transitioning it from female to male and having top surgery was popular to the point of being a trend. And I think any time you get into body modification as a trend, it just concerns me because, I mean, my sort of frame of reference for that is having done reporting about it and knowing that people die during this surgery, that it's serious surgery, and also having a mother who's undergone, you know, just endless surgeries for breast cancer and had an enormous amount of pain, you know, not from the cancer and not from chemo or radiation, but from the surgery itself. So I'm not somebody who takes surgery lightly.
Well put. I think that, you know, trying to deal with some of these ideas around making gender more fluid, though, it does always kind of point me in a direction to start to look at what could be seen as a harmful cultural practice. Like, that's basically what Sheila Jeffries writes about in terms of trying to have some kind of critique against the Western beauty practices that we engage in while we go into third world countries and are, you know, going after female genital mutilation and so forth, that we have to come from, while they can't really be compared, that we need to come from a rigorous self-examination.
Well, the thing that confused me so much in the boy, B-O-I culture, was that, you know, people kept saying to me, well, gender is fluid, and, you know, not, I mean, boy means different things to different people. It's not like a catch-all phrase, but for a lot of people, it was about being genderqueer and about sort of questioning the gender binary and questioning, you know, sort of, I mean, I would say questioning the sort of political correctness of a butch-femme dynamic. Now, if you're doing that and gender's so fluid, I don't understand. To me, it's like I don't understand how that goes hand in hand with the need to have body modification. Because if gender's so fluid, why can't you keep your body and redefine what it means? I mean, it's just not something that adds up to me completely. But, you know, I mean, everybody has to do what they want. So, I mean, I don't think my sort of job is to make rules. It's just, it's as you say, it's to question these things and sort of try to instigate discussion about them.
Right, and I think that was really the point on the Oprah show, which I thought was pretty wonderful, that, you know, maybe it got a little opening for a moment on mainstream television.
Right, right.
You wrote in your in a profile you did on Maureen Dowd that she was your idol, or that was hinted at.
No. She said she met me.
Oh.
She was kidding when she came up to me and had me sign her book. She said, just make it out to my idol. And she was kidding. I mean, that's the kind of sort of really funny, really sassy thing. That's sort of, you know, quintessential Maureen Dowd, is that she just, you know, that's her style, is if she talks to somebody, she sort of practices charm as a means of destabilization.
I see. The profile left me thinking more about her choice in outfits and home decor, that she's single, 53, that men can't resist her, rather than the substance of her work. Do you think her private life should define her and all women?
Do I think her private life what?
Should define her in some way?
Well, I think that she just published a best-selling book about romantic relationships between men and women. So as a journalist writing a profile about somebody who's just written that book, you're never going to not ask them about their private life and their sort of, you know, dating tactics. I mean, a book like that begs those questions.
Right. I mean, is this some kind of unwritten requirement for a journalist to expose personal details in a profile? I mean, I'm just questioning, is this your choice, or do you think it's more the editors of the New York Magazine?
Well, I think it's any magazine. I mean, I think if you're writing a profile, the thing that you want to do is offer your reader a sense of intimacy with the subject of the profile. And one of the ways you achieve that is by talking about their personal life. I mean, if all you talked about was their work, it would be pretty dry. And that's the point of magazine journalism when you're writing profiles, is to offer an experience of intimacy with the subject.
I was once profiled by Susan Faludi, and she spent a long time speaking to my family and friends until they, you know, gave her the pieces that they where they put me down, you know. Anyway, mm-hmm. I guess it's something to be expected, but it's always a little disheartening, given that I always hope that people could write more about the politics, the
well,
work.
Good
that,
journalism yeah. should do both. I mean, good journalism should give you a sense of somebody. I mean, that was my challenge when I wrote about Andrea Dworkin when she died, was to try to, you know, in a short, condensed form, give people a sense of what her writing was about and what her politics were about, but also give people a sense of who that human being was. And I mean, I think that that's the challenge of magazine journalism, is to accomplish as much of both as you possibly can. It's hard. I mean, it's not
right.
easy in a short space.
Yeah, after reading the profile you did on Dworkin after her death, I mean, and the piece that you wrote in the book on her, it seems that you don't like Andrea Dworkin. I mean,
oh, I don't think that's true. I mean, I mm-hmm. think I disagree with her about some things. I agree with her about others. But I think that, you know, I think she's a fascinating figure above all else. And I think she's an extremely underrated writer. In fact, right now what I'm working on is I was asked to write the preface. They're re-releasing Intercourse, one of her most famous works, and I'm writing the preface for it. And to me, I mean, the most important thing you can say about Andrea is read her stuff. I think she's debated far more frequently than she's actually read, which is a shame, because, you know, whether you like her politics or not, I mean, whether you agree with everything she's saying or not, she's undeniably, you know, a brilliant writer, a wonderful writer.
I'm glad you're mentioning that. She was a personal friend of mine, and I knew her since the 80s. And
oh, really?
Yeah. What I was interested in your book that you mentioned, to think that you're writing this new piece, I think, because you do mention in your book that, by quoting Candida Royale about how she, her take on Dworkin, and how that all, you know, all intercourse is rape, kind of a thing. You reiterated that myth.
Well, I reiterate that how it was interpreted, but that's not what she meant.
Right. It has been, she's explained it numerous times, and it's an I think, an endlessly fascinating thing for us to think about.
Absolutely.
About domination and the use of domination in sex. And
well, the thing is, though, I mean, the thing that I find, I mean, it's a puzzle, you know. Anytime you think you've sort of figured this out, you can always just keep going with it because it's not simple by any means. But, I mean, I don't think that the urge for sexual dominance is something exclusive to men, whether or not that's women sort of appropriating the culture. I mean, I just think that that's a confusing piece of the puzzle, that there's plenty of women who want that, who want to be sexually dominant, you know, themselves. So I think it's a confusing thing.
Right. I mean, I don't think she limits it to being just men who exercise that, but the idea that we eroticize the differential in power rather than eroticizing equality is what, to me, is the essence of what the point that she's trying to make. How do we speak about it in a culture that has not yet come to the place where they could eroticize equality and have that be the major get-off?
I guess to me, I mean, I think that what is erotic to an individual, I mean, I don't think it's only shaped by the culture within which you live. I mean, that's obviously enormously substantial, but I think there are other things that go into it. And I mean, I love reading Dworkin and I love considering her work, but I don't agree that eroticizing dominance is automatically something that you know, in every instance ought to be undone. I mean, I think whatever is erotic to people, you know, it's just so complicated. And I personally wouldn't sort of presume to tell people what they ought and ought not to find erotic.
Right, neither would I. But I think that our culture hasn't really allowed ourselves to have that conversation, to really consider what...
Well, that's why it's so great to read intercourse, to read Dworkin. And I mean, it just, you know, makes you consider those questions on a profound level.
When I was reading your book, I was immediately thinking of right-wing women. I don't know if you're familiar with that piece that she wrote. But she, you know, again, she was talking about how women acquiesce to male authority in order to gain protection from, you know, some protection from male violence, and wondered if you could comment about that, because you didn't really go into much about male violence in the book.
Well, it's not really something that I'm qualified to talk about. I mean, it's not something I've studied or researched or reported on, so it's just not something I'm qualified to speak about.
Okay. I know that Naomi Wolf calls Dworkin a victim feminist. What would you comment about that, or do you have a comment on that?
Well, I mean, I think that something that Dworkin was very explicit about was that she felt that victim was a term that had a taint but shouldn't, and she offered an unmitigated conception of the term victim. And to her, there was no such thing as a prostitute, only a prostituted woman. So, I mean, I don't know that, I'd be interested to, you know, I wish she were alive. I'd love to hear what Dworkin had to say about the term victim feminist, because I think that she was, you know, a lot less allergic to the word and the concept victim than many of us are.
Yeah, she does write about it in a variety of her essays.
Yeah, she does.
Yeah. So, I mean, unfortunately, we couldn't ask her today, but she has quite a body of work about how if we argue that women's choices are constrained and made within a context of powerlessness and male domination, then we're called a victim feminist, you know.
Right.
And how do we have that conversation while allowing us to consider the constraints that women live within? So to me, that's, you know, it kind of is, again, something that would be wonderful to have more discussions and debate about.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to just mention that in your book you had talked about Candida Royale, and I think in the piece on Dworkin you were calling, it seemed like you disliked Dworkin in the piece that you wrote. That was just kind of my take, but I guess as a personal friend I felt that, you know, maybe more sensitive to that, reducing her to an angry woman in overalls. And
well, every person I spoke to who was close with her did describe her as angry, and she talked about herself as angry all the time in her writing.
Right, but oops, sorry. But what about the overalls? I mean, isn't that...
Well, she did wear overalls. That was her uniform. I mean, she wore them a lot.
Right, but why wouldn't it be told in a way that she was breaking a rule that all of us, you know, you don't know me, but I mean, I still acquiesce to a lot of the gender stereotypes and the ways in which I wear my little gender identifiers when I'm uh-huh. out in public and speaking and so forth, that the kind of courage and bravery it takes to break that rule.
Oh, well, I spoke about her courage a great deal. I mean, I think it's a matter of interpretation. A lot of people who were very close to her really liked that piece, you know. I mean, her husband wrote to me and said that he had heard that they were considering me to write the preface for Intercourse, and he hoped I would. So, I mean, I think it really, you know, different people felt. It just depends on how you interpreted that piece.
Well, that's good. I'm glad to hear that. No, maybe you could, I don't know how much time you have.
We're running out.
I just wanted to ask what the response to the book's been and what you might add or change, or are you working on another sequel or another book?
Well, the response has been largely very positive. I mean, I think a lot of people sort of wanted, you know, were sort of hungry to have a discussion of these issues. And so, I mean, I don't really know how to measure it because I've never written a book before, so I have nothing to compare this to. But, you know, I've been pleased and surprised by, how positive the reviews have been and how many copies it's sold and how much press response it's gotten. I mean, it's sort of exceeded my expectations.
Well, that's good. And also, just to finish up, you wrote about the infamous Freedom trash can where women were burning objects that restricted women's freedom. If there were a Freedom trash can vintage 2006, what would you throw in it?
What would I throw in it? You know, implants probably. I'm no fan of breast implants.
That's great. Okay, well, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay.
Have a good day.
You too. Bye. We were speaking with Ariel Levy, author of Female Chauvinist Pigs, Women and the Rise of the Raunch Culture.
And the phone lines are open here on Free Radio at 427-3772. If you have any comments you'd like to make about the book or Ariel Levy, if you've any comments about the interview just now? Again, the number here in the studio is 427-3772 and the 831 area code. And also 469-3119, also in the 831 area code. So, did any of you have any comments about... we have some guests here in the studio today, and we also want you to stay tuned because we're going to have some women from UCSC who will be down here speaking about the vagina monologues and their work with the vagina monologues. So I have a comment here. This is Elaine.
Hi. I was hearing what she was talking about, and the latest tactic of the dominant patriarchy is women's degradation being portrayed as empowerment. And this is just a sad old boring rerun of Camille Paglia, who was a speaker, you know, a while back, and she said that women should strip to show their liberation, which is BS. I mean, anything that's degrading to women that is being used to titillate men is not empowerment. Empowerment of women involves economic independence so they can escape male violence. It involves the right to choose whether to not have children or to have children without some guy telling you what to do. Women's empowerment involves a woman being able to live her own life the way she wants to, as long as she doesn't harm anyone, without some guy telling her what to do. And so it doesn't have to do with being degraded and stripping and streaking and jumping around stripping to show how, quote, liberated you are. It's just another reversal of their tactic to keep us subservient to their whims.
So you essentially agreed with what she was saying, because that's the thesis of her book, is that these are not empowering. This is false empowerment. Once we are imitating a woman who's faking lust on a pole, things are looking down, because not only are we not, you know, in our own bodies, but we're actually trying to imitate someone who is paid and faking it. So it's, you know, kind of a bizarre situation. So you would essentially agree.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's very confusing that women live submerged in the dominant violent male culture, and it's defined as the world, and we should question where these ideas come from. Where did the idea come from where women have to pay to get mutilated if they're healthy to please men? Where do we get the idea we may have to have our breasts cut open and even our genitals operated on to please men? I mean, it's sad and ironic that in Africa, little girls have this procedure done against their will, and in the United States, women are actually paying to be mutilated.
Exactly. Well, to me, it's popular culture, clearly.
It's male culture.
Right, but it's popular male culture, and it's also women's culture now, because women say they choose it. Women say they want it. Women say they wear high heels for them, for their own, you know, they desire their choice. They want to wear high heels, that kind of thing. And Catherine here is also with us here in the studio. Hi.
Yes. Hi. I just want to make the comment that women who say they want it and they're doing it for themselves are brainwashed. It's that simple. They're programmed in a world that is patriarchal and capitalistic, authoritarian. And I don't think women, including me, can possibly know exactly what we want in a world that we're not free.
Yeah, she mentions that at the end of her book, that women deserve freedom and power, and basically that the book is about what the sex industry means in our culture and how we hold it up as an ideal and how we've distorted it to kind of fit in so that it becomes something that's cool and edgy or transgressive or whatever, when essentially it's very conservative. It's a very conservative stance to you know, it's not radical or transformative, and it doesn't involve freedom very, very much, though. So if you have any, if you'd like to join in this conversation, the number here in the studio is 427-3772 in the 831 area code. And also lines open at 469-3119. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is the Feminist Radio Show, and it is 10:30. And we'll be coming up at 11 o'clock and listen to some wonderful women performers from the Vagina Monologues. So do stay tuned. I'm going to play a little bit of music now, and I think we'll listen. Oh, we've got a caller. Okay. Let's go ahead and take this call. Hi, you're on Free Radio. Oh. Hi, you're on Free Radio. Okay, well, let's see. Maybe they're call back if I put the music on. Sometimes people don't want to talk on the air. So, again, this is Kate Bush.